Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. 1 million Syrians are trapped and suffering. Many have no shelter. Some sleep under trees, others in caves. Some have no food. And while we've been focusing on democratic primaries and the coronavirus, Syrian and other armies in the country's Idlib province are putting civilians in their gun sights and pulling their triggers. At the Greek-Turkish border and the waters around the Greek islands, Syrians from Idlib are trying to flee to Europe, but they are being pushed back by Greek and Turkish soldiers. The U.S. and Europe are doing some pro forma hand-wringing, but not much else. Why? This hour on Point, life and death in Idlib. Well, we're first going to start today with Joshua Landis. He's a Syria specialist and professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Josh Landis, welcome back to On Point.
A pleasure being with you.
So I want to actually start with the current sort of geopolitical situation that is causing this humanitarian disaster going on in Idlib. Today, the Turkish and Russian presidents are meeting. Can you tell us why? Why are Erdogan and Putin meeting about Syria today?
Because the struggle over Idlib province, this big province with 3 million people in it and many rebel fighters, has escalated. And it's brought Russia and Turkey into direct conflict. Russian planes killed about 36 Turkish soldiers only several days ago. And Turkey has struck back, shooting down a bunch of Syrian planes, three Syrian jets, and killing lots of Syrian soldiers. So Russia has to figure out whether it's going to push to take the entire province and has to really settle this calmness down with Erdogan today in order to bring some kind of stop to this escalation.
Okay, so remind us, though, Josh, about why is it that there are like Turkish outposts in Idlib, right? That are
there are 12 Turkish outposts and Turkish soldiers. You see, as the civil war turned in Assad's favor after Russia jumped in 2015, rebel forces from all over Syria were driven up into this Idlib province, which is stuck on the southern border of Turkey. All of them were being resupplied by Turkey, armed by Turkey, trained by Turkey, and of course, Western NGOs were helping with lots of the population in this area. So it became the last major outpost of the rebels. It was also the dumping ground for all the rebels. So Syria had, in a sense, herded them like fish into the Idlib. And Syria today is trying to take back that province. It's pounding it. There are tons of refugees, about 1 million refugees, who have run up against the Turkish border. Turkey has built a major wall, Mexican border, and these people can't get into Turkey. Mm-hmm. Turkey has recently opened that wall a bit and is allowing some of these people through, but it wants them to go into Europe, and it's compounded this big problem. And everybody, in a sense, is underlining the hypocrisy of almost every actor in the region, because they're all holding up the banner of human rights and helping refugees, but nobody is doing anything to help them.
Nobody?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. The United States went down there and said they would give an extra $100 million to help the homeless there, but the United States won't take any refugees in, and the United States is not helping Turkey with major arms because Turkey has taken Russian anti-aircraft missiles. And so Washington is very divided, even though our special envoy, Jeffrey, is saying we stand with Turkey. We don't want Assad and Iran and Russia to win this. They're not really doing a lot to help Turkey push back. And at the center of this problem is that the head of Idlib province is a man named Abu Muhammad al-Jawlani. He runs it. He was a member of ISIS and sent to Syria by Caliph Baghdadi to set up a branch of ISIS. He then split with Caliph Baghdadi and said he was loyal to Zawahiri, the head of al-Qaeda. Then he broke with al-Zawahiri and he set up his own organization, HTS, which America considers a terrorist organization. So in a sense, America has sided with Jolani and Turkey in order to keep Iran and Assad, who they consider more dangerous, out of Idlib province. And it's a real quagmire for the West. It's a quagmire for Turkey. And but it's all these people who live there are getting smashed underneath this big tug of war.
A million people. I mean, it's almost impossible to imagine the scope of the disaster right now.
It is. And there are 2 more million people in this province who could be driven out as well.
Huh. Okay. So, Josh, help us understand a little bit more about the sort of the particular sinkholes in this quagmire, right? Because regarding this meeting today between Erdogan and Putin, I'm seeing here that the Turkish president has a plan or has a desire to carve out a zone of control in Idlib province here. I mean, that doesn't seem like something Putin would support at all because Bashar al-Assad wants to maintain control over all of Syria.
Absolutely. Assad is determined to take this back, and he views the rebels there and many of their family members and the people as really not Syrians. He would be happy to drive many of them into Turkey. His attitude is much like, I suppose, you know, if Americans think of the loyalists during the Revolutionary War, where almost 20% of Americans were loyal to the crown and got attacked or driven out of the United States. That is the way that Assad and his government look at the people of Idlib. This has been a long time pro-Muslim Brotherhood region, even back to the 70s and 80s. Then it's where both the CIA, Turkey, the Gulf countries were training and funding rebel armies. He sees these as a collection of traitors to Syria, and he has no mercy for them. And that's why the brutality has raised up to this high level. Now, the rest of the world, of course, is trying to stop these people from being driven out to Turkey because they will go to Europe and they will cause havoc politically and in every other way in Europe. So it's really an effort, you know, underneath this is an effort by Europe and Turkey to block that border and keep those Syrians inside Syria, where the Syrian government is trying to take this province and drive them into Turkey.
Do you see any sort of sliver of even a sliver of a possibility that Putin would accommodate Erdogan's request for this zone in any way, shape, or form?
He might temporarily. We've seen this sort of go in stages. But ultimately, Putin has thrown in his cards with Assad. And he said in his big UN speech in 2015 when he heard Syria, he said, this is about national sovereignty and international law. And the government of Syria owns this territory. And anybody who supports insurgents is supporting terrorism. And we're going to go back to the internationally recognized borders of Syria. So he has staked his reputation on returning Syrian government Damascus Assad rule over every inch of Syrian territory. He does not want Syria divided up into different statelets.
Mm. And just to remind folks, there were a couple of rounds of talks in 2018 about Idlib. And if I remember correctly, Josh, those eventually ended up falling apart when reality set in on the ground in Syria.
Right. There have been a number of interim agreements. But ultimately, Russia and Syria state in every one of these interim agreements that this is a short-term fix and that ultimately the Syrian government is going to take over these territories. So that's the real problem is what would happen to Idlib if it's not under Assad? Will it be an independent state? Who would run it? Is it a temporary refugee no-fly zone? And Turkey is asking for the United States to come in and create a no-fly zone, help them create a no-fly zone over Idlib. And the U.S. doesn't want to do that. It doesn't want to get re-embroiled in Syria.
Now, set me straight on something, Josh, because it does seem as if there are so many examples of how sickeningly absurd this quagmire is. I mean, you pointed to the fact that the U.S. finds itself as essentially de facto supporting the head of Idlib province, who has links to ISIS and al-Qaeda. You mentioned the Turks having purchased Russian missiles, which they can't actually point, if I have this right, at the very Russian planes that are flying over Syria right now, because obviously the Russians aren't programming their own missiles to shoot down their own planes. I mean, this seems crazy. I don't even know how else to describe it.
It is crazy. And the American ambassador to NATO, when this conflagration between Russia and Turkey first escalated, she said, Bailey Hutchinson, she said, this will show Erdogan what a mistake he has made. I mean, not in so many words, but that America is Turkey's true friend, and he should not have moved into Russia's camp and taken these S-400s. And so America is really waiting for Erdogan to back down from its close relationship with Putin and to get rid of these S-400s. And then I think the United States would sweep in and show some real support for Turkey. But until that point, Washington seems very divided on what to do.
So, Josh Landis, we've got about a minute here left with you. You've been following this for so closely for so long. Does this absurdity, tragic, horrific absurdity, seem like it can be solved now? Can this be solved?
Well, it could be solved under slow, if there is, it is very difficult because Turkey has really put down, Erdogan has staked his reputation on keeping some part of Idlib and his position in Syria writ large, because he owns other parts of northern Aleppo province. He's taken a big buffer zone along the whole northern border of Syria, which is almost 500 kilometers long. So this fight that we see between Russia and Turkey, between Syria and Turkey, is not over anytime soon. There is a lot of territory that's still going to be contested. You know, everybody in the journalists always say this is the last rebel enclave, but that's not true. This is just one major rebel enclave. There are more in northern Aleppo and along the whole northern border of Turkey. So this is far from over.
Well, Joshua Landis is a Syria specialist and professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. His website is called Syria Comment, and we have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Josh, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
When we come back, we'll talk to a reporter who spent years covering the war in Syria. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about life and death in Idlib province in Syria. I'm joined now by Josie Enzor. She has just been named the U.S. correspondent for the British newspaper The Telegraph. But until just 1 week ago, she had spent 4 years covering the war in Syria based out of Beirut. Her final dispatch from Syria is an opinion piece titled Syria, Where the World Collectively Lost Its humanity. And we have a link to Josie's piece at onpointradio.org. Josie Ensor, welcome to the program.
Hi.
So first of all, I wonder if you might be able to give us a much more concrete sense about the conditions that Syrian refugees in Idlib are currently trying to survive in.
Yeah, so as Joshua was saying, Idlib province is something, is home to 3.5 million civilians. I emphasize the fact that I'm talking about civilians here. Obviously, there are a number of fighters, but they are in the minority. And these people live, in an area the size of Vermont, and they are pushed up against the Turkish border at the moment because of advancing Syrian troops. I'm in a lot of WhatsApp groups with Syrians on the ground, and they talk about every day the conditions that they're living in. And we talk about 1 million people who have been displaced since December, which is the largest single mass displacement of the war. 20,000 of them are without shelter, meaning the temperatures in Idlib are in minus degrees at the moment, and they have absolutely no shelter whatsoever. So they're sleeping, under in olive groves, in chicken coops even. And quite a lot of children and babies have actually died of pneumonia and cold-related illnesses.
I'm reading one of your reports. This is from the 11th of February, where you're saying after the mosques filled up, as you said, people began sleeping in olive groves. But of course, when it being winter, there aren't even any leaves on the trees, if I understand that correctly, to keep people warm. Some people trying to survive in caves, and there isn't a you have a quote here from someone saying there's no house of concrete or mud or even a chicken coop that is not inhabited. I mean, it sounds awful.
Yeah. I mean, I've been reporting for, as I said, 4 years on Syria, and I think the situation in Idlib now is quite possibly worse than it has been at any time in the war. And in my last piece, I talked about the fact that, every year I covered Syria, I thought that the next one would somehow be better or it would somehow be more positive. But, I mean, every year seemed against all the odds to get even worse for the people of Syria, many of whom, aren't involved in the daily politics of what's happening and the geopolitics of what's happening in their own country. Hospitals are bombed weekly, and this is not an accident, it's a design. Mm-hmm. Assad has kind of used this policy of terrorizing and areas by targeting civilian structures like hospitals and bakeries and things that people rely on for food and for medicine. And in this way of terrorizing, it ends up depopulating areas, which obviously, as a military strategy, makes it much easier to retake these areas.
Well, we are talking about the humanitarian crisis currently ongoing for many years now, but the latest chapter of it in Idlib province in Syria. Josie Ensor joins us. She is a journalist who works for The Telegraph, the British newspaper. She spent 4 years reporting on Syria based out of Beirut. And so, Josie, in your last piece out of Beirut, I mean, as I mentioned, the headline is you said this is Syria is where the world collectively lost its humanity. Tell me more about why you're saying that.
Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of people say to me, it was a powerful piece and I enjoyed reading it, but it was just, very, very despondent, very negative, I try to be realistic. I mean, we like to say farewell and have some sort of positive message to leave people, but covering Syria, a time like this is just, I honestly didn't feel like there was anything positive to say. I was quite surprised by the reaction to it because, I have some followers on Twitter, but this one was, I think, liked 22,000 times or something. And I think I was struggling to figure out why this had kind of resonated with people, why this had, had so much traction. I think it's because people, it captured this sort of sense of helplessness that the ordinary people have who are following Syria, who have been for the last few years. I think also in America, I think Syria is sort of the place that the US lost its power and its influence, and it was seriously challenged by Russia and by Syria. And I think while America and its allies were kind of playing tiddlywinks, I think, Assad and Russia were playing chess. I mean, we were playing different games from sort of 2003, 2013, 2014 onwards. And I think yeah, it's, I mean, it's not a feeling we're used to having of watching this war in real time. And I talk in this piece about how, you know, more war crimes are documented in Syria than in Nazi Germany, and defectors and medical doctors, surgeons, they've been documenting all this. We have the Caesar files, which documented just how many people were tortured and killed in regime prisons. And we've been watching this in slow motion for the last few years. And I just think perhaps that piece sort of, it was a difficult one to write, because as a journalist, you want to be able to kind of talk about your achievements as a reporter, and the reason that we cover areas like Syria so that we can, you know, hopefully make some measure of difference. And I talked about Marie Colvin, you know, the celebrated US veteran war correspondent who was doing this in 2012. And she hoped that, you know, something that she was doing would move the needle, that people would react, and they just never did, and nothing ever happened. And I think, you know, everyone going into it thought, you know, I can make some small difference, whatever it is. But I just kind of left feeling like, you know, I hope it was, we were on the right side of history, but I just felt like, you know, it was just such a tragedy, and to leave in a situation where, you know, the future of Syria is so uncertain still.
Mm. And we should mention that Marie Colvin was killed by in Homs, right? While she was reporting, by regime fire, I believe. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, there was a lawsuit brought by the family, and the conclusion had been that she'd been in a kind of a media center controlled by the opposition in Homs, surrounded by government forces, and they'd kind of used a tactic of bracketing, which is kind of hitting the house she was in, knowing she was in it, and then finally striking it. And basically, the conclusion of that lawsuit here in New York was that it had been deliberate. It had been a deliberate act by the Syrian government.
Mm. So, Josie, I wonder if we could just take a step back here, because I've said a couple of times that you were based in Beirut but reporting about Syria for 4 years. And I think one of the things that's hard for people who are nowhere near the region to understand is how is it that, how does that happen? Like, were you able to get into Syria frequently? How did you get in? How was that reporting done?
Yeah, so most Western correspondents for, you know, the New York Times, Washington Post, Telegraph, Times of London, we do not get regular access to government-held Syria. There is a kind of unofficial blacklist of correspondents who do not write in a way that the Syrian government is happy with. And that ends up essentially you kind of being blacklisted from getting a visa. So a lot of us apply for the Syrian visa in the embassy in Beirut. Some of us hear back saying, you know, your reporting hasn't been independent enough, which is the reason they give to a lot of people. I just never hear personally. They just say, you know, we're investigating your application, and I just never heard back, basically. I applied about 3 or 4 times. I did go to government-held areas in 2016, just before the Aleppo offensive. I went with the British Syrian Society, and we started off in Damascus, and then we went to Aleppo just as the kind of the Russian troops were going into Aleppo. And we were there in 2016. I was told, you know, you're welcome back, you can come back anytime. And then I went back to Beirut and applied again, and my application was rejected. So a lot of people, you know, criticize us for not going to government-held areas, but, you know, for the vast, vast, vast majority of us, we want to be going to these areas, and we want to be reporting what we can see from those areas, because we know that, you know, the rebels are also committing war crimes, and they've also targeting certain areas in certain ways, and we want to be able to go in there and do more objective and independent reporting. But unfortunately, that's just become almost impossible for journalists that have been there for a long time. So, I mean, the trip I did in 2016 was incredibly illuminating, incredibly interesting, and I wish I could have gone back. But the problem is, a lot of us did reporting then from the northeast of Syria, which is held by the Kurdish authorities, which are not recognised by the Syrian government. So if you go into the Kurdish areas, you're then considered to have entered illegally, and then you're not allowed to re-enter Syrian government territory. So, you know, I've done 5-6 reporting trips to the Kurdish-held areas to report on ISIS. to report on the aftermath of ISIS. So then I became officially banned after that.
Just so I'm clear, in what year did you become officially banned?
I mean, I started going to the Kurdish areas in 2018 when the offensive against ISIS properly kicked off. But, I mean, a lot of the reporting that we do, unfortunately, has to be through WhatsApp, through Facebook, through social media. And so, you know, we've had several offensives now. We've had the Homs one, we've had the Aleppo one, we've had the Deraa one, we've had the Sweda one. And all of these we're kind of forced to follow them from social media. So a lot of us journalists and activists on the ground and doctors are part of a kind of a group WhatsApp where people share videos, people share kind of first-hand accounts of what's happening. And with Aleppo, you know, we were watching in real... I mean, it's very unusual for this to happen, to be a war correspondent and to watch things kind of happening in real time like that. You know, doctors who were sheltering in basements where the hospital had just been hit, asking us for help or asking us, you know, how to get out, or trying to, you know, updating us with live updates about how they were, you know, rescuing children, babies from maternity wards and stuff like that. And I think it was very, very hard for us to report like that, because, you know, this kind of cognitive dissonance of being in Beirut, which, you know, people who've been in the region know, it's quite, you know, they've got quite a good nightlife, and correspondents often go after they file to have a late night drink or a late night cocktail. And, you know, life didn't stop in Lebanon because there was a war next door. And I think that's quite right. They had their own war for 15 years. And I think if you know, life stopped every time there was a threat of war, a threat of conflict, then Lebanon would be in a sort of state of semi-paralysis. But yeah, it made it very, very difficult for us to, you know, to report and also to, you know, confirm what we were seeing as well.
Mm. Well, you had said that your last reporting trips when you were able to enter Syria were very eye-opening. I think I'd love for us to be the direct beneficiaries of your experience there. I mean, what did you see? I mean, tell us about what it was like.
It was incredibly interesting just to see the kind of machinations of how the government works. I mean, we had dinner on the first. It was me, Anne Bernard from the New York Times, the Washington Post was there, NPR was there actually, and we were sitting having dinner in these kind of luxurious Damascus hotels, and I was sitting next to the tourism minister. I mean, unbelievably, the tourism minister had anything to do at that time, but the tourism minister and Bouthina Shaban, who is, you know, Bashar al-Assad's spokeswoman, and Fawaz Akras, who is Asma Assad's, Assad's father-in-law, who is the director of the British Syrian Society, who was hosting us. So we were sitting at dinner, you know, having this luxurious meal where we knew that the vast majority of people outside were kind of suffering from economic depression at the very least, if not, you know, the constant threat of war and violence. And then we were given an opportunity actually to go to Aleppo. So, I mean, the highway was closed at that time because various parts of it were controlled by the opposition. So we had quite a, you know, hairy journey by bus, all of us. I kind of thought at one point, like, you know, if this bus gets targeted, basically every single Syria correspondent in the world is going to get wiped out. But we made it to Aleppo, and it was very surreal. We were staying in the Sheraton Hotel in Damascus, and then we stayed in its sister hotel in Aleppo. And I just remember, because it was kind of my first rodeo, it was 2016, and I remember Christina Lamb of the Sunday Times, we were put into rooms at the top of the hotel facing the rebel-held area. And I remember her saying, maybe perhaps we should check into the other side so that, you know, if anything hits the hotel, first of all, we're not east-facing, we're west-facing. And also, you know, maybe want to be on a lower floor if something happens. So we actually, you know, I got them to move me down a few floors and facing a different direction. But yeah, I mean, we heard thuds all through the night, and there were, you know, several rebel rocket attacks that time. And then we were taken to a hospital the next day. And I remember we interviewed the medical director, and then just as we were coming out onto the kind of the forecourt of the hospital, it was just so surreal. All these patients started arriving. First of all, there was a soldier who kind of had this sort of weird wrapped bandage with this red mark on it. And I honestly thought at first, because I've, you know, heard so many things about Syria, that this was put on for us. I mean, it was kind of a bit, the timing was a bit too good to be true. And just to be able to, you know, be in time to see something like that happening. So my first thought was honestly that it had kind of been staged for us. But then, you know, women and children started arriving, and there'd been a double suicide car bomb by the rebels, I think, on the border of East and West Aleppo. And then children and women started arriving, and we did see a lot of dead bodies, and we did see a lot of people sort of die in front of us. And we realised then that it hadn't been staged, and we corroborated from the rebel side that there had been attack on that side. And it was a very powerful moment, and I think all of us were kind of slightly stunned and humbled by it. And we went away and reported it. But there was also another odd incident that I thought was worth talking about. That often the government puts forward people for you to talk to, mm-hmm. who are on their side, if you know what I mean. I mean, we asked them, we'd love to speak to someone who is in the rebel-held area, who's, sought refuge in the government-held area recently and has arrived. And they're like, yeah, we can find someone for you. And then after sort of 2-3 days of waiting, we reminded them and said, if there's anyone we can speak to who's just recently arrived from the rebel-held area. And it didn't appear that they could find anyone. And then suddenly, as we were leaving the hospital, they were like, oh, Ahmed. And then some guy came over to us, and we were like, oh, what was it like? And he was talking about, the rebel terrorists and how his family were still trapped there and all the awful things that the rebels had been doing. And that's not to say, there weren't crimes committed by the rebels, but it had turned out basically that the government, this guy had been a minder with us the whole time. And, he wasn't who the government said he was, so we kind of had to be very mindful that not necessarily everything we were seeing and witnessing and hearing was as it was presented, right. Basically.
Well, we are talking with Josie Ensor. She was posted in Beirut and covered the war in Syria for 4 years for the British newspaper The Telegraph. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with Josie Ensor. She is a journalist for the British newspaper The Telegraph. For 4 years, she was posted in Beirut, where she was reporting on the conflict in Syria. She's just been named the U.S. correspondent for The Telegraph, and she joins us today to share with us her experience reporting from Syria, what the conditions are there for the millions of people who have been displaced, particularly in Idlib province right now, which is the location of the world's largest ongoing humanitarian disaster. Josie, let me just take a couple of calls here because we have some interesting questions coming in from our listeners. So let's go to Carlos, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Carlos, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. Thank you for getting me on the air. It seems that there are great omissions in the media reporting what's happening here. Erdogan's invaded Syrian territory and to destroy some Kurdish towns. And that was recently. Now the situation is that there is a territory that is being held against the government, and it is Syrian territory. If you think that, for instance, let's say white supremacists will take, some territory in the United States, the United States government will, try to get them out, try to, recover the control of the territory.
Mm.
And that's exactly what the Syrian government is doing right now. Now, it seems clear now that it is Turkey responsible for all the misery that the Syrian civil war happened.
Carlos, I think you're asking kind of a fundamentally important question about how we categorize what's going on in Syria, and I'll ask Josie about that. But you're really blaming the Turkish government for, say, the Syrian regime's deliberate bombing of 60 hospitals, at least?
Well, if I can explain, the press usually says, the rebels, got weapons, right, in order to fight the Syrian army. But those weapons came from somewhere, right? And now it is clear that, now that Turkey has actually invaded, parts of Syria and is trying to control that territory, that it is Turkey behind, this civil war thing.
Okay. Well, Carlos, let Josie, who has been in the region for several years, let's let her respond to this. Carlos, thank you for your call. Josie, what do you think?
I think it's quite an interesting question. I think Syria divides people into camps, and often these camps just cannot seem to reconcile with each other. This sort of anti-intervention camp and the sort of not even pro-intervention camp, but there is a group of people that just sees any intervention in Syria as a bad intervention that will likely exacerbate what's the problems that are happening in Syria. And those types of people tend to see the Syrian sovereignty is the greatest thing in all of this. Obviously, Syria itself has invited a number of outside countries to help in its fight against the rebellion, including Iran and Russia. The situation is incredibly complicated. I do think that the Syrian government needs to be held to a higher standard in the war because they are the government. Mm-hmm. The war started essentially as a fight for democracy. Civilians, normal people rose up against a government that, a family that had been in a dynasty that had been in power for several decades and looked to be in power for several more. What began as a kind of a fight for democracy and revolution was taken over eventually by a kind of more extremist Islamist element. But the problem is that what we're looking at here is a group of 3.5 million civilians. And it's unclear what would happen if countries like Turkey and its allies didn't do something at this point. Because Assad and the government and Russia has proved in the past to, multiple times, according to the UN itself, bombed hospitals, bombed civilian structures, hit civilian areas. And while a lot of people's gut instinct is to be anti-intervention in any case, I think what we would see in Syria, if there wasn't any kind of intervention, either from Turkey or from anyone else, would probably be one of the kind of greatest slaughters of the 21st century.
Mm. Well, let's go to John, who's calling from Portland, Maine. John, you're on the air.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is, since the group that they're fighting against is the caliphate, and basically they're not friendly to anyone, if they were in power, they would put all kinds of bad rules on their own people. They wouldn't. It's not a democracy group. They want to make Sharia law, this and that. So I don't see what's the problem with the Russians and the Syrians just bombing the heck out of them because they're an infection to the land. And if they don't eradicate them, they're just going to continue on pestering the region. And then secondly, I was wondering how many actual Russian troops are there on the ground and how many of them are actually fighting with the Syrians. And that's basically what I wanted to say.
Hey, John, so let me ask you a question. So I think you're pointing to something interesting, which is one of the things that's at the base of how the world looks at this conflict. I mean, you're saying like there's a geopolitical strategy here, which maybe you agree with. A lot of people might say that. But when you also say like you don't see the problems with the Russians and the Syrians bombing these areas, we're talking about civilians who are on the receiving end of those explosions many times.
You know, that's a sad thing, but this is the thing. unfortunately, bombs, when they blow up and they're big, 500 pounds, 2,000 pounds, they eradicate a lot of people. When we go to war in America and we bomb places, guess what? We do the same thing. We kill civilians. We kill children. We do the whole same thing they do. So what's the difference between them and us? We do the same thing when we go to war and we drop a bomb. It's called collateral damage. That's what they call that. If a government really cares about its people, it won't have its people near that stuff. And the people in Syria need to get away from
it. They can't get out, John. So this is the thing. They can't get out. The Turks won't let them in. The Greeks won't let them in now. The European Union is collectively in a panic that more millions of Syrians will try to enter the European Union. These people are trapped.
Yeah, but when they're doing their bombings, they're bombing military targets. It'd be wise of a person who's there in that conflict to stay away from equipment and people that are actually fighting, because that's who they're going to target. So if you're next to a piece of equipment over here that's used in war, you know what? When they look from the air and they see that on satellite photographs, they're going to bomb that. And if you're around it, you're probably not going to have a good day.
Yeah.
But there is, even if you did everything you could, there's still a chance that you could be killed because it's war. But what are you going to do? Let's look at the alternative. Do you pitch your head in the sand and let these people run around and set up an Islamic State and caliphate and all that? I mean, what do you want them to do? What would you do?
Well, John, I appreciate your call. And before I let you go, just out of curiosity, did you serve in the U.S. military in any way?
I served in the United States Marine Corps. I was a Marine. I was in a recon unit.
Okay, great. So you bring your firsthand military experience here. Did you serve in? Were you ever deployed in the region, in the Middle East, anywhere?
No, ma'am.
Okay. All right. Well, John, thank you so much for your call. Josie, did you want to respond to what you heard John say?
Yeah, I think there is this sort of dangerous narrative that Idlib is this al-Qaeda stronghold. And I think we forget in all this that there are something like 30,000 fighters. I mean, many of them have probably been killed at this point because the offensive has been going on so long. And if you look at that and then look at the figure of civilians, which is something like 3.5 million, and as you said, there is nowhere for these people to go. And I don't think, you know, our caller talked about this idea of collateral damage. And I think we have seen several times in the war that it's not a matter of collateral damage, it's a matter of a deliberate strategy. You know, a school was bombed every day last week. Hospitals, as you know, quoting you from before, I think at least 60 to 70 hospitals and medical facilities have been hit since the beginning of the offensive. And you know, I talked to medical groups that work on the ground, and what they did was in good faith share the coordinates of their medical facilities and hospitals with the UN in a working group that then shared it with Russia and who then would have shared it with the Syrian government. So if there's an attack on one of these hospitals where the coordinates have been shared, this is obviously not an accident. And the problem is that the UN currently doesn't have a strategy of holding both parties in this to account. So when people talk about bombing and collateral damage, I think we have to kind of look at what's actually happening on the ground. And, you know, the New York Times had a great story on audio communications from the Russians that were leaked to them that showed that they were deliberately targeting these hospitals. And, you know, the Telegraph shared some similar audio communications that showed that the Syrian government was deliberately targeting civilians. In one case, there were some elderly women who were packing up their things and trying to flee, and they shot at them, they fired at them anyway. And as I said before in this conversation, that it's a deliberate strategy to kind of terrorise a civilian population in order to depopulate, in order to make it much easier to take over these areas. And so a lot of war crimes have been committed that, you know, we as an international community have to acknowledge.
Right. So there have been some videos of Greek naval forces, Greek sailors with their faces covered, taking shots at inflatable boats full of, I guess, men, women, and children trying to flee Syria. Should we be pointing a finger of blame at the EU and at Greece for not doing more, and then perhaps more broadly at the United States for not aiding its European allies and trying to help solve at least the humanitarian edge to this disaster right now?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly disappointing as a European. Well, probably I should just call myself British now, but you know, the refugees in this situation have been pawns in a massive political game. And I think the last migrant crisis, which obviously saw more than a million fleeing from the Middle East and Afghanistan towards Europe, I think changed the face of European politics. I mean, we saw the rise of a lot of far-right parties in response to that. But, you know, we are a continent. We are a continent and we're a developed union, and we have the ability to absorb more than a million refugees. I mean, if you look at Turkey, a population of 80 million, and they took in 3.6 million Syrian refugees. So you can understand from Turkey's point of view why quite possibly they just literally do not have the resources to take in any more. I mean, they were given some money, billions of euros, as part of the EU-Turkey deal, but it wasn't enough. And the idea of possibly, you know, double that number again, you can see from Turkey's point of view why they've opened the border with Greece and that this is happening. You can also see from Greece's point of view why they might be terrified of another influx, because they're still, you know, struggling to deal with the last one. But I think as a European Union, we should take responsibility for accepting more refugees in. I think UK took in 20,000, which wasn't, you know, a huge number. And I think, as I said, we have the ability to absorb much more without creating a crisis. Mm.
And let it be reminded that the United States is basically accepting none. Let's go to Liz, who's calling from Vallen, South Dakota. Liz, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. And thank you for this serious journalism. It makes it so real and cutting past all of the discussion of governments and countries and, you know, resources. I just feel desperate. I think about these families that are stuck, that are being bombed, that are being killed, and I don't know what to do. You know, what can an American do? I mean, I want to just go over there and grab them all and bring them to safety. You know, but it's such a huge crisis. It just causes me despair. Mm.
Liz, thank you for that question. I'm sure it's a question on the minds of a lot of people. Josie, can individuals do anything?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think people in America forget how important the American elections are for, you know, who becomes the leader of America greatly affects what happens in the Middle East. And people follow the US election news as closely as they do their own news because, you know, they worry about who's going to be in charge of America because that affects so many decisions in their life, you know, whether their country is going to get bombed, whether they're going to get accepted if their country does get bombed. I think, you know, helping campaign for candidates that you think will be helpful to the situation rather than, you know, help create a greater tragedy that's happening in Syria. There are, you know, I'm happy to share some organizations that help with Syrian refugees. I think it's quite difficult to help the Syrians inside Syria. Mm-hmm. I mean, America's 1 million that it 100 million that it recently donated, you know, should go some way to trying to help some of them that are literally without homes and without shelters. But yeah, I mean, there are some charities and organizations that I'm happy to share, you know, online with you guys.
Yeah.
But I, as I said, like, you know, I think people forget how important these upcoming elections are going to be for a lot of people who live in the region.
Right. Well, we'll definitely have our producers get those names from you after the show, and we'll put them on our website, onpointradio.org. But, Josie, we've got about a minute and a half left. I'm just curious, how has reporting on this disaster, how has it changed you?
I think it's just been incredibly profound to report on something like Syria. You feel like you have a lot of responsibility because, you know, you have to give a voice to people who are otherwise voiceless. And my colleague at the BBC shared, you know, when I was talking about the fact that I felt like I'd had my work, you know, looking back on a body of work for 4 years and hoping it had some impact and just realizing that it hadn't, you know, maybe in collective consciousness it's had some impact, but it just kind of felt like we'd been banging our heads against a brick wall. And I kind of just wanted to share this quote that this my colleague at the BBC shared with me when I posted my own story, and it's one by Martha Gellhorn, who's probably one of the most accomplished war correspondents in America of the last century. And she said, "All my reporting life, I've thrown small pebbles into a very large pond and have no way of knowing whether any pebble caused the slightest ripple. I don't need to worry about the responsibility. I don't need to worry about that. The responsibility is the effort. And I thought that was kind of, you know, a good way to think about it, that, you know, you can't always affect things as a journalist, but at least you can kind of change opinion.
So it's the ripples we put our hopes on. But Josie Ensor, she spent 4 years reporting from Beirut on the Syrian war for the British newspaper The Telegraph. She's now The Telegraph's U.S. correspondent. We have a link to her reporting at onpointradio.org. Josie, thank you so very much for spending this time with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people, who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.